April 2019 in Maine, the month in review. April has not been the loveliest month, at least weather-wise, but the Maine State House has been relatively warm and dry, and legislators have been working their way through a slew of bills. Last Friday, Governor Mills signed a major one, which eliminated the Columbus Day holiday and replaced it with Indigenous Peoples Day, making Maine the sixth state to do so. Also this month, legislators grappled with the concept of paid leave. There are several bills working their way through committee, including one sponsored by the Speaker of the House. And Maine's congressional delegation has been reading and responding to the Mueller Report. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Which stories mattered most to you in April and why? We'll discuss them with our panel of editorial page editors next. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We are talking about the news from the month of April, and with so many issues before the Maine legislature now, there are plenty of topics to talk about. Joining me, our panel of editorial page editors. With me in our Portland studio, Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal, Morning Sentinel, and Central Maine Sunday. And Greg Kessich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News. As always, we want to hear from you. What issues are you following? What matters most to you this month of April 2019? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for joining us and welcome back. I want to start with what happened last Friday, that Governor Mills, after a not close vote in the Maine House and Senate, signed Indigenous Peoples Day into law in Maine, replacing Columbus Day. Greg Kessich, this has come up before. Why now? What was the change that made this not only happen, but happen sort of like relatively easily?
Right. That was the strangest thing to me, was sort of how it just slid in. We think of the past as this immutable thing, and in fact, it changes. Our view of history changes over time. Columbus Day was created in the 30s as a way to honor Italian Americans. You know, it's interesting. Columbus, if he were alive today, probably would not identify himself as an Italian or an American. He was from Genoa, which it was its own little empire, and he was flying under the flag of Spain.
Spain, that's right.
And so he didn't, you know, I don't think he really ever, Italy didn't even exist until the 19th century. So this idea that Columbus is the first Italian American was kind of a creation of a particular time. Over time, if you were to go to an island and do what Columbus did today, they would not say you discovered the island. They would say you're committing genocide. When people come to realize sort of what happened after that first moment of setting foot on shore, it becomes harder and harder to defend as a point of celebration. It's a historical fact, but it's not necessarily something that we need to celebrate in the way that we've been taught to celebrate it. So, a lot of places have gone to Indigenous People Day, replacing Columbus Day, going back to the 1990s.
A lot of cities.
But a number of states now, too. There was four states up until just recently, and I think there's another four on the way.
Yeah, Vermont about the same time as we did.
Yeah.
Do you think this is part, and I'll ask you this, Ben, part of a broader, opening of looking at tribal relations? I'm thinking about, on a national scale, what we've all seen with the Keystone Pipeline protests, but in more locally, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Are these all related?
I think so. I mean, it's all kind of a recognition that we need to kind of look at what happened in the past to some of the, to the Indigenous peoples and how they've been mistreated not only way back in Columbus time, but all the way up through to the present day. So there's, kind of a more general awareness of those issues among more people, and a lot of them are in the legislature. As you said, this has come up before and not made it. This year's this legislature in session now is just really kind of more attuned to those issues. And as you said, no one was really, you know, in a time when everything brings up a big partisan fight, this didn't kind of devolve into that. There were disagreements over it, but ultimately there wasn't some big constituency to come in and fight it on the other side. And certainly the Mills administration has made, making sure that they're showing the main tribes that they are listening in a way that they maybe haven't been listened to in the past. So that's at least a small part of this.
Susan Young, how significant do you think the change from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day is? And does it signify something bigger?
Well, it sounds very trite, but as the governor said, you know, history is written by the winners. And I think we're getting to the point where we're taking a closer look and taking that to heart. Also brings to mind, you know, rethinking Civil War and the statues of some generals and folks who, you know, maybe weren't really that heroic and are coming down in cities in the South. So I think nationally, we're taking a harder look at how we remember history, how we're celebrating history, to make sure that we're not giving too much credence and, you know, goodwill to people who don't really deserve it, and at the same time trying to be more cognizant of and telling the stories of the people who wrongly were overlooked, forgotten, or, you know, in worse cases, purposely left out of history. And I think it's great that we're taking a more conscious look at the history of everyone involved in these events, going back to the, quote, discovery of America, as Greg said, you know, not being discovered. So on one hand, you know, you can argue it's symbolic to change the name, but I think it's important what it signifies and the other actions that are coming along with it. As you mentioned, the Maine Indian State Tribal Commission governor hoping to restart that group and going forward having a more collaborative discussion and relationships with tribes and making sure that all the people of Maine are heard by their government.
Let's talk about the paid leave proposals that are working their way through the State House. I understand there are about five. The one that's gotten the most coverage is the proposal that's been put forward by the Speaker of the House, Sarah Gideon. Ben, I'm putting it on you. What do most people think of as a paid leave proposal? What is actually being proposed? What looks like might happen? I mean, I think a lot of people who aren't paying close attention think paid leave means we mandate employees to pay people for time off when they are sick or have a baby or something like that. And that's not what we're talking about, is it?
This proposal that's on the table right now and is kind of the subject of a compromise bill would make companies with more than 10 employees on a full-time basis, on a year-round basis, offer paid leave. Right now, the bill calls for 1 hour for every 40 hours worked that you earn paid time off. And it was a paid sick leave when it started, but it is now changed to just paid leave, which simplifies it both for the employer and the employee. It's not just, if your parent's sick or your kid's sick. It's if your car breaks down, if you have an appointment otherwise you need to get to, if your aunt is really sick and you're really close to her, you don't need to prove that you're that close to her to get a day off. And then for the employers, they don't need to police any of that stuff. They just know that you have a legally mandated number of days off that you earn and that you can use them, in emergencies when you need to. And so that's what's on the table right now.
But my understanding, it's almost like an insurance pool that a little bit of your paycheck is going
to be
taxed.
I think there's two different bills.
I
think
see.
You guys are talking about two different things.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Ben is talking about Representative Millett's bill
would be
paid sick days. And it came out of committee with a partisan vote and was headed to be defeated, probably. You know, who knows exactly. But there was speculation that it wasn't going to pass the Senate. And if it did, it was going to run into trouble with the governor. And apparently, the governor's office worked with all the parties, and they came up with a compromise, which Ben just described, which creates a pool of you can earn a certain amount of time off, up to 40 hours throughout the year. And it doesn't quite cover everybody, and it has it preempts any local government from doing this, which is a big issue because there's such a pending ordinance in Portland that would be more restrictive, and this would preempt that, and they wouldn't be allowed to do that. So that's one bill, and that looks like it's going to pass. It did very well in the committee, and it has the support of the business community as well as the people behind it, and it means there's not going to be a referendum on it. The speaker's bill is different. It's a payroll tax. I'm forgetting the fraction, but it was something like a half a cent on income above $12,000. And that would be used as a pool to give you time off when you have a medical leave or when you have need to take care of somebody. And that one, I think, has a much less certain future. But it's got some very, you know, powerful people behind it, especially Speaker of the House Sarah Gideon.
So they're not competing bills. They're sort of in the same area. One is more about needing a day off, and one is more about needing extended time off.
I mean, the paid sick days came from do you want, the dishwasher in the restaurant where you eat to have the flu?
Right.
And people who have jobs where they don't get paid for days. Maine has a requirement that employers have to give you paid time off when you have a baby or some other leave, but they don't have to pay you. And so it's not a benefit that a lot of people are able to take advantage of. So this would create it's a little bit like unemployment insurance. You know, it's a payroll tax, and it would create a like you said, an insurance pool that would pay you for when you're out.
Is this modeled on another state? Is this something that happens other places?
It does happen other places. I don't remember which ones.
Okay.
But I think we're going to learn a lot about it next week. it's certainly not in the majority of states. And the question is, does it, would passing this, violate the governor's campaign promise that she wouldn't raise taxes?
And I want to turn to you, Susan. The question that I asked about Indigenous Peoples Day as well. Why now? Is the answer to why now because there's a potential referendum coming?
I think that's part of it, but also you have Democrats in control of the legislature and a Democrat in the Blaine House. So I don't really like calling it a wish list, but they're going down their list of things that they've hoped to accomplish for a long time. And certainly sick leave has been on that, the paid leave in this form, perhaps not so much. So I think those are both factors in, you know, why their efforts to get these things done, too. And to your question, are they competing? No, but as Greg and Ben highlighted, there's a lot of confusion because both proposals are on the table. So, you know, what's the cumulative impact of passing if both are passed at the same time? What's the impact particularly on smaller businesses? So they might not be competing, but I think we have to think about what happens if both go into effect.
Sure. And small businesses are the predominant business in Maine.
Yes.
Yes, most people. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you'd like to join the conversation about the stories in the month of April that mattered most to you, give us a call. 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. In researching the program today, I sort of looked up, when did the Mueller report, the redacted version, come out? And I kind of can't get my head around the fact that it was not even 2 weeks ago. It seems like so much longer ago, Greg. But let's talk about that. The Mueller report, first, the summary comes out, and Shelley Pingree and Angus King ask for a more complete report. The more complete report comes out, and how does our congressional delegation respond? And how do politicians in Maine respond?
Cautiously, like politicians everywhere. It's a Senator Collins said that she was going to take the time to read it, and it's 400 pages long, and that could take quite a while. I think Senator King came out with the most detailed response the day that it came out, with pointing out that it, in fact, verifies that Russia did actually try to interfere with our election. You know, this idea that it was all a witch hunt and it wasn't based on anything is been pretty well substantiated now, not only by the intelligence community, but by a, you know, respected prosecutor. So there's that. You know, the question is, what makes this difficult for politicians is that people are really divided on this, like everything. You know, like Ben was saying, he was surprised that Indigenous Peoples Day didn't turn into a big divisive issue, because everything is divisive. There, I saw there's an ABC Washington Post poll. I think it's the first one I've seen anyway on this issue, and it said that a majority of Americans, 58%, think that Trump lied during the course of this investigation. And you know, not surprisingly, Democrats, 90% say he lied, and Republicans, 19%. You know, a significant number of Republicans, but 61% of independents think he lied. When you ask them, should he be impeached, it flips 100%. And 56% say he should not be impeached, and you're looking at almost 60% of independents saying he should not be impeached. So there's a sizable number of Americans who think that the president is a liar who lied to an investigation of a foreign policy conspiracy of a foreign power trying to interfere in our elections. And in the course of that investigation, the president lied, and they're okay with that, but they don't think he should be impeached. So if you're an elected member of the government trying to figure out how to navigate that world, good luck, you know.
Yeah, but it doesn't put much of a premium on the truth, which is something all of us in this room care about.
Right. And you know, I think we ought to point out that the reporting on this has been really well substantiated by Mueller. He had FBI people and subpoena power and a grand jury. And, you know, if you lie to one of them, you go to jail. And he basically substantiated a lot of what you read in The New York Times and The Washington Post.
OK, Susan and Ben, I want to hear what you have to say, but we're going to go to a break. So we'll talk Mueller when we get back. And we'll also hear from you and our audience. Please call and join the conversation. 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Abbey Museum Indian Market in downtown Bar Harbor, May 17th through the 19th, featuring an art market, fashion show, film festival, and performances. And by the Maine Pottery Tour, May 4th and 5th, celebrating ceramic arts with 40 studios around Maine, including Homeport Pottery in Kennebunkport. Maine Pottery Tour.
All Things Considered reports on, well, everything. But how does a story come together? I'm Audie Cornish, and first, journalists at NPR share ideas.
Morning, everybody. Working leads today, China trade talks.
After China, can we go back to the soybean farmers?
We hunt for a pitch that's timely, newsworthy, and compelling.
I'm kind of with Mary Louise on an analyst voice.
From there, producers search for the right expert to speak to a given topic.
I'm calling from NPR. I've been in contact with Richard Clark.
A director ensures the mics are on and things are to time.
I'm going to bring in Mary Louise. She wants to just say hi and kind of run through what we'll be talking about. And we'll get a level for you as well.
Then it's airtime.
Former White House counterterrorism chief Richard Clark. Hey there.
Yeah, it's good to be with you.
Every step is important, and it all starts with you. When you give every month, you help the news get made. Become a sustaining member now.
Our Let's Grow Together membership campaign starts Tuesday, May 7th, but you can contribute right now at mainepublic.org or by calling 1-800-866-1475. Another night of television worth talking about tonight on Maine Public Television at 9 o'clock. It's Rocky's Kingdom of the Sky as we meet the amazing wildlife and remarkable people who inhabit this 3,000-mile mountain range, home to cougars, wolverines, wolves, and grizzlies. Then at 10 o'clock, it's Frontline, The Last Survivors, which is a landmark documentary about some of the last survivors of the Holocaust. Only children at the time, these now elderly survivors, reflect on how the trauma of the Holocaust has affected the rest of their lives.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we're talking about some of the top Maine news stories from the past month. Joining me, Susan Young, editorial page editor with the Bangor Daily News, Greg Kesich, editorial page editor with the Portland Press Herald, and Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor with the Kennebec Journal. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Before we went to break, we were talking about the Mueller report, our congressional delegation's response to it, and just overall thoughts. And that, Susan, I could hear you wanting to chime in, so go.
I mean, to follow up on Greg's point, I mean, we're oddly left with kind of so what? I mean, it confirmed what so many of us have known is that, yes, the president is a liar, you know, did some things that were clearly wrong in directing other people to lie. They didn't follow through and do it. So maybe there wasn't really obstruction of justice. What does it all add up to? And, you know, without support for impeachment, and it certainly sounds like there isn't enough support in Congress to move forward, then what happens next? You know, Republicans are saying, you know, it was a complete exoneration. You know, we're good to keep going forward. Democrats are saying we want to see what was redacted from the report. We need more hearings. But where does that get us? And as Greg mentioned, it leaves politicians in a really awkward spot because people believe that the president is a liar, but they seem to not want anything done about that because they don't support impeachment. There's not really a middle ground there. So I guess we all just keep going forward with that information, but it's a very weird circumstance. And the most important thing, you know, as Senator King has been pointing out for well over a year, is that the Russians interfered in our election. They generally don't have the same interests as we do, so this should be really concerning. But again, there's kind of a collective shoulder shrug. You know, what are we going to do about that? How do we make sure that they don't interfere again or even more in 2020? But you're hearing very little talk about that, especially from Congress. But, you know, it's just a very odd situation with such damning information, but it feels like nothing is going to be done with it or about it.
Ben?
Yeah, I mean, we can kind of see this dynamic kind of setting up over the last couple years where kind of absent a signed videotaped agreement between Putin and Trump that said, would you like to commit some crimes so you can become president? And he's like, yes, I'll commit some crimes with you. That the people had already kind of decided what it is. I mean, I think the main Republican Party, the Mueller report was released, I believe, at 11:30. The main Republican Party released a statement at 2 o'clock giving Trump total vindication.
800-page document,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And I mean,
they read more quickly than I do.
Yeah, very dense. And if you look through that, if you actually read the report, that the idea of total vindication is insane. It's just that's not what it says. But we have a Republican president who is enormously popular among Republicans, and we have a Republican Senate that will not leave his side because of all the political ramifications of that. You could get impeachment in the House. You could pull together enough people to get impeachment in the House. It wouldn't lead to him being removed from office. So I think a lot of people on the left say, what's the point? And you know, we might just hand him, you know, the chance that we might make him look sympathetic, that he can argue that he's being hounded after this report. So you have a lot of people are just saying, man, what's the point? Let's adjudicate this in November of 2020. However, it should be, you know, it falls to when you have something so complicated as the Mueller report, so deep into law, so based on these, Department of Justice policies and things that we don't quite understand as non-lawyers. It takes leaders to describe that to people. And when you have, major Republicans coming out and saying that, you know, this is a complete vindication, that signals to everybody else below them that they can just move on from it. And so that's, you know, but we should be really concerned about what's in that report, about a president who lies over and over again, who almost solely uses the power of his office to strike back at his enemies and to inflate his own ego. And also, to Susan's point about Russian interference, that was the point of this whole thing. The point was to find out how deep the Russian interference in our election was, and it went very deep, very deep. Up to the point maybe where they could have changed outcomes in a few. I mean, they've not changed outcomes, but changed votes. And they don't think they did. There's no evidence that they did, but they may have had access to it. It's very important that we know those things. And now that we know them, it's very important that we act on them. And there was a report just last week that the former head of Homeland Security, Kristian Nielsen, who just left her post, had been trying for months to get a cabinet-level meeting together to address Russian interference. And she couldn't do it because no one wants to talk about it around the president because it hurts his feelings. And that's a really bad spot to be in. And I think there's a number of those things in our government. And I'd be a little scared at what we don't know is not being done.
Can I just throw one more thing out?
To build on Ben's point on, you know, things that we should be concerned about, Attorney General Bill Barr made it pretty clear that he views his job as working as the president's attorney. Mm-hmm. And that's not his job. His job is to represent the best interests of the American public in the legal realm. So I would just point that out as another issue that we should be very concerned about, that he appears to not be doing his job.
Well, he out and out lied at to roll out. I mean, we were all waiting for that, you know, that first remark, and he said no collusion, no obstruction, which was if not a lie, at least, you know, a pretty big fib,
misrepresentation
of the fact. And then before releasing the report, he held that weird press conference and said that Mueller's determination not to charge the president with obstruction did not have anything to do with the Department of Justice policy to not indict. Like that the president can't be indicted. The Department of Justice says a president cannot be indicted while in office. And a lot of people were saying, well, Mueller's decision not to say the president should be indicted comes from that, which would mean that there might be evidence that he otherwise would be indicted. And Barr said that wasn't the fact. Mm-hmm. But in the Mueller report, he says that over and over again, that there is clear evidence for a prosecutor to pick up. And if it seems pretty clear to me from what I've read from mountains of stuff that if the president wasn't the president, he would be facing an obstruction of justice charge. And, you know, what do you want to do with that as the American people is up to you. But it's pretty serious.
Greg.
So I just want to throw this one thing out. I was driving over here and I was thinking we're living in a kind of a weird period where people are less interested in foreign affairs than any time that I can remember. I grew up during the Cold War, and we were constantly being talked about what things happening in other countries, Vietnam, Central America. And then certainly after 9/11, there was a huge focus on what's happening in the world and you know, the non-state actors and the crumbling countries, you know, the crumbling autocracies and how that was affecting us. And then I feel like since the financial collapse of 2007, 2008, there's been very little interest in foreign affairs. And, the only time Trump talks about foreign events is how it relates to us in terms of trade or immigration. But there's not really a lot of focus or interest in what's happening in these other countries. And, you know, it's strange because if you grew up during the Cold War, you think that the most important thing the president does is conduct foreign policy. And now it just seems to be not that important. And I think that's relevant to this Mueller report because people are, you know, I think the ambivalence the polls are showing is that people feel like it doesn't affect me. It doesn't affect my life if Russia got involved in this election. Certainly not if it didn't, you know, wasn't decisive in terms of Trump winning. And I think that's a very kind of dangerous place to be.
Sort of the selfishing of the American electorate.
Yeah, drawing in, you know, inward focus.
We're going to go to Constantino calling from Westbrook. Hi, Constantino. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you today?
Good.
Well, I've been listening closely to your conversation, and I think that the lethargy and apathy that you people are describing is somewhat clear, but it's about accountancy. And when you issue subpoenas, you should, you know, and then people are held in contempt, you put them in jail, and then, you know, the dominoes will start to fall. And it just seems to, after a while, that people don't see any action. There's lots of hand-wringing, and I'm deeply concerned, and that sort of thing. And to flip it on its head, you know, the Russian interference thing, look at it this way. Putin is in a tough situation, too, because he's got a bad economy and he's dropping in the polls. So why aren't we cyber interfering with him, painting him out to be, a less than effective president? It just seems to me that there's, you know, nothing being done.
I'm sure we are in a lot of ways.
I mean,
you know, there's a lot of
like Radio Free Europe and Voice of America. Have been longstanding propaganda
also,
operations.
Yeah, and Russia doesn't really have free and fair elections for us to influence either. I'm sure we are doing a lot of those things.
But
on
I think
some level.
Constantino's point is kind of what Ben was saying, is that people look to leadership, and if they see like ambiguous action and a fear of going too far, then they kind of read from that it's just the usual political back and forth.
We saw that here, right? I mean, Governor LePage just stopped sending commissioners to the committee hearings.
Mm-hmm.
Stopped, you know, that he kind of cut the legislature's oversight ability, which is what, you know, Constantino is referring to, is that the Congress has this duty to, regardless of party, to oversee the president. And they didn't do it at all for 2 years when it was Republican majority. And now that Democrats have the House and they're starting to issue all this stuff, the president's just not answering them. And that, to Constantino's point, is just not a sign of a functioning democracy. And I mean, these are going to go to court and maybe he'll get ordered. But I think everybody in the Trump administration now either gets the idea that you don't talk or you leave. Or not don't talk, but everyone understands, because there's plenty of leaking, but everyone understands how the president feels about he's kind of chilled, you know, over transparency in his administration. And a lot of the good people have left and a lot of the sycophants are left behind. And we're going to get a look into it maybe, but is it going to be 6 months, a year, you know?
Susan, I want to bring you in. Are you dying to jump in up there in Bangor?
I mean, I would point out, I think on one hand, it's fair to say it feels like nothing has come of the Mueller report. But, you know, his investigation has resulted in indictments against nearly three dozen people. And I think eight of those people have pled guilty to the charges that were brought against them. Some of them are serving time in jail, have served time in jail, or will soon be serving time in jail. So, you know, there's nothing happening at the top, obviously, but there certainly have been consequences for folks. And, you know, perhaps there's more shoes to drop, as Constantine said, as, more people talk, then the web just gets bigger and bigger and more complex.
Yeah.
So there have been consequences. They just haven't affected the president and, you know, the folks in his cabinet and others at the top.
And we don't quite know what is going to come out of some of those other criminal investigations, the ones that were spun off from Mueller into New York and other places. I mean, that's where there's some real landmines up ahead for the president, maybe.
All right. Well, when we come back from this break, we're going to talk about some things other than the Mueller report and Trump. I promise. We're going to take a quick break. Your comments and questions continue after the break. You're listening to Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine, welcoming school groups to visit the Michael Klar Center in Augusta to learn about the Holocaust and human rights through their interactive exhibits and free educational workshops. HHRCMaine.org. And by the Maine Pottery Tour, May 4th and 5th, celebrating ceramic arts with 40 studios around Maine, including Red Door Pottery Studio in Kittery. Maine Pottery Tour.
Buried Truths is an award-winning podcast covering stories of injustice, resilience, and racism in the American South. Its first series just won a Peabody. Its latest tells a story that resonates today, a cop shooting an unarmed black teenager in Georgia in 1962. Buried Truths, that's next time on 1A.
Join us tonight at 9 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. It's very simple. Listener support and public radio, they both make each other happen. It's what happens when the two are in sync. If you value this service, count on it. Listen every day. Trust it. And you aren't doing your part financially, please think about it. Keep public radio strong and loud and clear. Our spring Let's Grow Together membership drive starts Tuesday, May 7th. We hope to hear from you then or right now at mainpublic.org. Together, we'll keep this relevant public service strong. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Jennifer Rooks, and you are listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the news that made headlines this month. Our panel of editorial page editors joins us. That's Greg Kesich with the Portland Press Herald, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, and Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. An email from Tom. We have heard a lot in the national news about potential consequences some parents of opting out of having their children vaccinated. What is the status of LD 798 to address this issue here in Maine? Ben, do you know the answer?
Yes, it's passed the House and is awaiting votes in the Senate. All indications are that it's going to pass, I think.
Do we think the governor's going to sign it?
And the governor's going to sign it. Yeah, I think so. I think that's the... Yeah. Was looking forward. And then this is at the same time there's been some, a measles outbreak in New York, and there's some kind of mandatory vaccination going on. That's this wouldn't be mandatory vaccination. It would be you have to get vaccinated to send your kid to school. I mean, it's a little different, but it's, you know, we're not going to fine anybody for not getting their kids vaccinated. You're just not going to be able to send them to school.
Or arrest them, or you know, drag them, you know, in terms of consequences. I'm not sure what he meant, but it would be you'd still have the choice to vaccinate. You just couldn't send your kid to a public school.
We'll go to Bob, who's calling from China. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. This is great. Actually, I'm calling about the NECEC, which is the CMP Quebec Hydro line for power for Boston, I guess you could put it. I know the governor and the PUC both are in favor of this, and it almost seems like it's a done deal. We're waiting for the DEP to rule. But I'm really opposed to this, as are almost the supermajority of Maine people, and I don't know whether that can be changed. The only way that I would want to see this go forward is if they put the whole darn thing underground. Back in 98, we had an ice storm that took out those big towers in Quebec. That didn't happen here, but that's not the way to go. If they put it underground, then you have less risk of sabotage. There's a great movie, Women at War, an indie film that I saw in Waterville, that just shows how easy it is to sabotage those lines. And then the third factor is the herbicides that are used in our Maine woods. So unless they do those things to put it underground, I'm opposed to it. And I guess you can see my passion about that. Uh-huh.
Well, Bob, thanks for calling in, and you do speak for a lot of people. Susan, we are indeed waiting on DEP, right?
Right, but there's also the bill in the legislature to require or request DEP to do an independent study of the long-term environmental greenhouse gas benefits or not of this project. And Ben, you're much closer to the legislature than I am, but it looks like that bill might pass. So I don't know how exactly that will affect the situation, since DEP deliberations, or you know, at least their consideration of the project, are already underway. But if they're required to take this additional step, that would at least slow down the project.
Yeah, it seems like it might have the votes there. I haven't heard the governor talk about it, so I'm not sure where that stands. It would certainly slow things down. There's a lot of people that feel like Bob, a lot. And I think it's been the most popular topic for letters. It has been for months, and I continue to be. People up there all along the corridor really feel kind of personally affronted by this project, and there's a lot of pent-up anger up there, and they're just waiting for somebody to act. And I think a lot of people put their hopes in Governor Mills, and then she made the deal with CMP to back it, and then they've kind of, you know, and then kind of moved on to the PUC and then the DEP. So that's where we're at. That's where we're at now. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the next few months.
Bob, thanks for your call. We'll move on to Patricia calling from Fort Kent. Hi, Patricia, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for the program you have for calling, open call-in. I'm calling because I am of Native American and European descent, Irish, and the Native Indian that were from Allegash, Maine. And I'd like to make sure that Massachusetts does an Indigenous Day awareness, very much so, especially in Swansea, because I have my history book, and the Dominion of New England, okay, in 1676, and to defeat the Native Americans there in Massachusetts and take their land from them, what they did was they quartered and left to rot the body of the one they called Philip, giving him a Christian name. And what they did to all of the warriors and their families, the majority of them, they were captured and put into the hulls of ship and sold into slavery into the West Indies. Now, how do you take care of that for America, talking about slavery and you know, doing this to Indigenous peoples? I mean, we're not acknowledged in Allegash, Maine. And up there, we come from mainly Irish, Scottish, and the Native American comes from the shaman, the female shaman, because there were only men allowed to come over when the big ships came over. And the men were in the woods. They did not favor knotholes and trees. They favored the women. And because of the color of their hair and their eyes, the tribe had decided that the best that they had of their women and their daughters, which is the shaman women and their daughters, were given, okay? And so this is where we originate from. And I have a lot of memory of different medicinal things and different...
Sure. So I guess, Patricia, what you're asserting is that, you know, you agree with what Maine has done, and you will hope that Massachusetts will follow suit.
I most assuredly hope so, because it's like this central Maine power issue that's coming, put it underground. It's still coming through land that belonged to us. It was taken, okay, by the Dominion of England. And, you know, this is so inferior, and yet they don't do anything to recognize us. Okay, from the Allegash, everybody else down through, and it's a hard fight to do that. And so, and Central Maine Power, it said on your program, when I listened to it a few weeks ago, that if there's no electricity in Maine, Massachusetts gets first option of all of our men who work here to put our reconnect us with our electrical power for us to have it. And we will not ever have it until Massachusetts is taken care of first. Maybe I'm saying it wrong, but
sure.
I don't believe
sure,
I am.
Sure, Patricia, this is something that Massachusetts is behind. Thank you so much for your call.
I think her point about, you know, about the history is really important. I think when you look at Martin Luther King Day, the way that's celebrated as opposed to a lot of our other holidays, it's taken as a time to really talk about the civil rights movement and talk about the, you know, the history of African Americans. And I think Indigenous Peoples Day could be the same thing. It's not like going to be a holiday that gets celebrated the way, say, you know, some of the other maybe the 4th of July, it'll be an opportunity to, you know, to talk about history and how we got to where we are now.
An email from Cynthia. In my opinion, far too much time has been spent on the presidential nomination issue and the Mueller report drama compared to the truly serious and consequential issue of stemming global warming. Every day's news lineup should include an item on actions and developments around solving the climate crisis, which directly bears on our children's prospects for a livable world. Giving climate change a backseat to political gossip is not wise, given the prospects for catastrophe. This is an email from Cynthia. I'm reading between the lines here and think Cynthia is not just talking about Maine Calling today, because we haven't even talked about the presidential nomination, but just what is out there in the sort of broader media today, that so much focus on who's running for president and what's going on with the Mueller report. And she wants to see more focus on climate change with, and again, a little aside, that is one of our focus this year on Maine Calling. Susan, but we'll as an editorial page editor, I'll toss it up to you. Conversations about covering climate change.
Yeah, it's also a topic of focus for us. We picked four issues to talk about, you know, a little more in depth on our pages. And actually, climate change was our reader's choice. So it's an issue that, you know, we've been devoting attention to, as we have for years. It feels a little bit like we're stalled at some point because of the Trump administration and their disdain for climate change, you know, moving in the other direction to limit regulations on coal-fired power plants, on discharges into waterways. And, you know, the scientific community certainly believes that climate change is a big problem, and, you know, lots of Americans do as well. But when you have an administration that's not at that place and is doing things to make the situation worse, you know, it's really hard for people to know what they should do, what they should think. As we pointed out, you know, this is a novel idea, but, you know, the action is at the state level. The governor is going to give us more details on her plan. You know, at the town level, there's efforts to ban plastic bags and styrofoam. You know, a lot of things going on a smaller scale, but a lot of frustration at the national level that it's not a top priority. It's not even something that they're really taking seriously. And that's going to be a big problem, you know, in a few years and way down the line, I think.
I'm going to be optimistic for a second, out of character.
How's Ben?
There's a really good story this week. I think it was the New York Times about gun control advocacy since Newtown,
Sandy Hook,
and how, you know, after Sandy Hook, it was quick that they went to Congress with something, and then Congress shot it down, and we all just kind of felt that's it. A bunch of kids got shot, and no one did anything, and we kind of lived in this area of frustration. But other people went out and really worked at it, and the fruits of that work is now coming up. And I mentioned that with climate change, because I think a lot of us who have been around this issue for a while just got stuck in it because it just seemed like nothing was ever going to happen. But there also seems to be a kind of a big global consensus coming around among young people who are really pushing this. And I just saw a story the other day where a number of young Trump supporters are kind of separating themselves from the party on that issue and saying, no, this is something we need to talk about. So, you know, this next generation that's coming up, I think, is a little bit more realistic about it than maybe we are, and a little fresher to it. So they're still not, you know, beaten down by the fact that we, you know, can't get anything done. The problem is we're on a clock, and the clock's ticking, and we don't have time to spend a decade discussing the best policy. But I think there's at least a little bit of sunshine out there.
Yeah. If you wanted to design a problem that would be impossible or immune to the news media, it's climate change. It happens. It's invisible. It happens slowly, gradually over time. We're focused on events that we can see and hear and touch, where news is in our name. So it has to be new. You have the possibility of throwing out competing experts, even though I think hopefully we've gone past that era where we don't have just like one of each. You know, we acknowledge that there's an overwhelming consensus on one side. So it's a really difficult for the way our industry is structured for us to put that issue on the front burner, even though I think most people in the news media would agree it's the most important issue out there. And like Susan said, if you got the president saying it isn't happening, then the only way you really have to deal with climate change is to talk about replacing the president with somebody who thinks it is happening, and that's when you get into all this political talk.
Okay, I'm going to try to squeeze in one more call. We're going to go to Bear calling from Wells. Hi, Bear, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, but if you can be quick, that would be great.
Okay, I just wanted to say I'm in solidarity. I'm a European-American male with the woman that called in from Allegash. And that I think the problem, she was talking about the underground still affecting Native Americans. And so to me, the overall problem is decentering whiteness and, you know, putting whiteness where it belongs with everybody else. That's all I'll say on that one.
Thanks, Bear.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think a lot of us are just kind of learning the language that we can talk about that. I think people automatically get defensive when they hear something like whiteness because of what that means to them personally and what they think about that it's saying that they got something they didn't deserve or something like that. It's very personal. But I think a big part of it is just continuing to talk about it and talk about it and use the language and to listen to people in Maine who are who are not white, which is sometimes a problem.
Quick email from Chris. Where are the Bill Cohens in today's Republican Party? Susan, do you have an answer?
Hiding under their desks, I think. I don't know. I mean, it's what we talk about so much. You know, we know there are still moderate Republicans in Maine, but where are they and why are they so hesitant to speak out as the party, you know, their lessons from the midterm election was that they weren't mean enough. And I can't help but believe there's a lot of Republicans that think that's the wrong message to take. And it's very frustrating that they're not speaking out. And I'm not, you know, if anyone has any great ideas about how to get them to speak out, we would certainly welcome that.
That's going to be our last word. Thank you all for joining us today. Our guest today, all newspaper editorial page editor Susan Young, is with the Bangor Daily News, Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel and Central Maine Sunday, and Greg Kessich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Sandra Harris ran the board today. We had additional help from Rich Tozier in Bangor. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as all sorts of links and resources, always, at mainecalling.org. Today's program will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.